Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. My name is David Inge. Glad you could be here for our program. In this first part of the show today, we'll be talking about defense planning in the post-Cold War era. And our guest for the show is Gordon Adams. He is director of the Defense Budget Project in Washington, D.C. This is a project that has been in existence since 1983. He is the founder of this group. It conducts analysis of defense issues and serves both houses and parties of the Congress, policymakers, the media, and the public. Our guest, Dr. Adams, has given testimony before Congress on a number of occasions and does a lot of talks and interviews like this. He's visiting the U of I, and we're glad to have him come and spend some time with us this morning. He, in a talk that he gave yesterday, he made the point that for a long time, defense planning in this country was driven by the perceived threat. That is, we thought about the danger that enemies mostly, I guess for a long time it was the Soviet Union, the danger those enemies posed to the United States, and then we decided what sort of defense we would need. More recently, as budgetary constraints have become more and more important, it is the concerns over money that have started to drive defense policy. And his feeling is that that's going about it backwards, that we really ought to be thinking more about just what we want our defense structure to do, and then look at what it's cost and what it's going to cost us for that to happen. As we talk about some of these things this morning, you should feel free to be a part of our program, call in, ask questions, and make comments. Our telephone number is 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, but we also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere you can hear us, and that's 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and 800-222-WILL. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I want to start talking a little bit about the peace dividend. And whether or not, in fact, there is a peace dividend. I think in Washington it seemed that once we got to the point where everybody was generally convinced that the Soviet Union was no longer the threat that it was, and at the same time as money seemed to get tighter and tighter and tighter, there was this impulse to run to the defense budget and try to pull large chunks of money out of there to do other things with. And, you know, you would have thought that people on the Hill had gotten that letter with Ed McMahon's picture on it and hadn't bothered to read the fine print. What do you think we can say about the peace dividend? Is there a peace dividend?
Well, it's probably one of the most mythological beasts in American budgetary parlance, I think, is to at this point to talk about a peace dividend. Obviously, we are in a position in a changed world with the disappearance of the Soviet Union, with a very different set of circumstances globally, where we can make the armed forces of the United States both smaller and, I would argue, different for reasons we can discuss. Having been in a position to do that, we obviously will be, I think, spending less on the military than we spent at the peak of the Cold War. Exactly how much less is a little bit hard to describe, and that's one of the reasons this peace dividend seems so evanescent. It's kind of now you see it, now you don't. We throw numbers in Washington and across the airwaves around as if they had some reality. So President Bush says a $50 billion peace dividend, or Senator Mitchell says a $100 billion peace dividend, or just the other day Senator Nunn says an $85 billion peace dividend.
Thank you.
We will be spending for defense. The difference is something called a peace dividend, and the problem that you have in realizing that dividend when you get down to planning is that both the base from which you calculate it is going to change year by year by year, and the economic assumptions, inflation and the like that go into planning that number are going to change year by year by year, and as a result you can't bear hug the number. The number is always going to change on you. It's like chasing your shadow. It always disappears on you. About the only basis on which you can actually arrive at a relatively hard number is on a one-year basis. Now you can say, last year I told you I would need X amount of money for defense. This year I'm telling you I need Y amount of money for defense. It's about $8 billion in the Bush budget proposal. It's probably about $15 billion in the Democratic alternative coming out of the House of Representatives. They're both saying, I think in the framework of some reasonably set budget parameters for 1993, I can spend this much less on defense. And then the question becomes, what can you do with the money? Now, those aren't very big numbers. When you get to numbers like $8 or $15 billion, well, for you and me in our pockets, that's a lot of money. But if you assume that you want to do some things about reducing the deficit, because that's important, and you want to do some things about taxes, because people seem to have the idea that that's important, and you want to spend some bucks on some other things, well, when you split a, say, $9 billion pie three ways, that's $3 billion each. And after a while, it's not a very big sum of money. In our view, what's important here is not so much trying to construct unreal numbers that go out to 1997 or 2000 or whatever and say, I guarantee you those bucks are going to be there. You can't deliver on that promise. What you want to be able to do, in our judgment, is, as you suggested at the top of the program, you want to set some decent planning parameters for the size of a force structure that's geared to the role we think the United States should play in the world, and start walking towards that structure. And year by year, as you begin to bring down the number of people in the military, the number of divisions, the number of battle groups in the Navy, the number of carriers out there sailing, the size of the Air Force and the number of aircraft in it, as you go towards your target, you're going to save money that you would otherwise have spent. I can't tell you the exact number. What I can tell you is when I get you to the year 2000 and you've reached that size of the force target, I'll turn you around and point you backwards, and you'll look and say, golly, you know, if I hadn't done that, I would have spent X. Having done that, I only spent Y. What's in that, which is a relatively measurable number, is what I got as a peace dividend. I can't foresee it for you, but I can tell you when you turn around and look backwards, you will have gotten it. Then, of course, the key is planning what your priorities are in federal spending, not just transferring the peace dividend, but planning your spending priorities, what's important for America.
Well, I suppose then, you know, what some people will say to that kind of analysis is they will look at the world as it exists now, and they will say, you know, what truly does the United States have to be concerned about? What sort of adversaries do we have? And we look at the big one that we used to have, and we'd say, you know, does it seem reasonable that the Soviet Union is going to launch an attack against the United States? And we have to say, well, no, it seems like the probability is pretty low. Do we really have to worry about the Soviet Union conducting land war in Europe? And probably, again, the probability is pretty low. So if we look at all of the things that we had thought we were preparing for before, we see a pretty changed landscape. And so Absolutely. Some people will say, you know, given that fact, why don't we be really bold and we go in and we say, look, why don't we just take a big whack and say, we're just going to do it. We're going to cut $100 billion or $150 billion. We're going to cut it in half and go from there and be able to realize what, see, when, then one would hope then you could take that money right away and put it into other pressing needs that the country has. And certainly there are a long list of things on the domestic side where we would like to right away have some money that we could take and we could put into those to those problems. Why can't you do that?
Well, there's two issues that need to be dealt with here. This is what I call a raid on the bank approach. Defense is the First National Bank of Defense. We don't really care what's inside that box because the Russians are not a serious threat. So let's just go in and lay our hands on the change and run with the money, as it were. There are two issues that need to be dealt with here. One is where you should start defense planning. That is to say, where does our military capability fit in with our foreign policy goals, our diplomatic capabilities, our economic strengths and economic problems? In other words, you need to define a national strategy. One of the biggest weaknesses that we have, I would argue right now, both from the Republicans and the Democrats in Washington, is that there is nobody who is coherently articulating a sense of national strategy. And your national strategy has to link up your diplomatic and political capabilities with your economic strengths and your problems, with your military capabilities. Those things aren't in a zero-sum relationship to each other. It's not one or the other. It's all three of those things. If you don't do one of them well, you can't do other things well. I'll give you the classic example here. If American diplomacy had drawn a line in the sand for Saddam Hussein long before the Gulf War, we might not have had the Gulf War. The problem is our political diplomatic capabilities failed us in that instance, and we ended up with the Gulf War. On the other hand, if you're going to draw the line in the diplomatic sand for Saddam Hussein, you better be able to back that up. Otherwise, it's a hollow line. It's an empty threat if you can't back that up with capability. What we don't have is any yet coherent, sensible, long-term vision about America's role in the world and the role of military forces as part of your three-legged stool, if you will, your political, diplomatic, your economic, and your military. We haven't conceptualized that relationship. Once you've done that, you then need to figure out what the functions of military force are in that relationship. And the way you've described it is strictly one of what I think three functions of military force for any power in the world. Those functions I would describe as reassurance and deterrence and the capacity to prevail. Now, we got misled, if you will, by an unusual historical aberration, 40 years of a known enemy with a known military capability posing a known threat both to Europe and directly through strategic forces to the United States. And it was always easy for us to answer the question, what's the role of the United States in the world? Because it was to deter, to contain the Soviet Union, to reassure our allies that we continue to do that and play that function in combination with them, and to be able, we hope, to prevail against the Russians should it come to that. Well, now we've got a new world. There's no Soviet Union. And yet the history of international systems and international relationships tells you that there is always a function for your military forces as part of your package of national strategy. Now, can it be smaller than it is today? You bet. But that brings us to your second question, which is how fast can you make it smaller? I think you have to answer the first question before you can answer the second question, which is how small and how fast do you get there? Mm-hmm. The problem with getting there quickly, the kind of slash and burn approach to defense planning, the problem with that is you pay real prices. If military Behind in the force, and a management problem for the military in terms of having a capability that fits and that can work militarily. So there is a number, there's a rough number, there's the speed at which you can pull people out of the military and not run into those problems. And the same is true if you want to operate and support them. You can either devastate and create a hollow military by pulling down the operations and management number too fast, or you can set a trajectory and get your dollars gradually as you bring the forces down. The same is true for buying military hardware. If you really want to get a big bunch of savings in 1 year, money you can spend on something else, you could get all of it by killing hardware programs. But we got $54 billion in the budget for 1993 for hardware. To get the money that even the president wants to get from defense for 1993, if he did it all on hardware programs, he'd have to strip out $31 billion of that money, which creates a devastating impact in the industry, in the workforce, in terms of your capability, in fact, to provide the hardware according to plan. So you want to be more careful about that. You could say the same about research and development spending, which is an important hedge. You can say the same thing about Department of Energy programs, where you want them to play a role in dismantling nuclear weapons and cleaning up the devastated wasteland that is our nuclear production complex. In other words, you've got goals in all the things you want to do in the military that you also want to spend money on. Now, I'm not saying don't take it down. This was responded to yesterday as being basically an inside the beltway argument about why you can't get money out of defense. You can change the defense plan. And as I said at the beginning, if you turn around and look backwards, you'll have realized a lot of savings as you went through that process. But both because you don't want mayhem in your military capability while you get there and because you want people to agree when you're done that that was about the right thing to do, I would argue that you set that long-term goal. It's deeper than the base force that Colin Powell describes. And every year you make decisions that get you toward that goal. And as you do it, you're going to reap fiscal capacity to target your pet peeve. Now, of course, everybody has different pet peeve. Some people want to reduce the deficit, and that's all they want to do. That is not a waste of money, because given the demands on investment capital in the United States for a growing economy, we'd better reduce that deficit, and even the Democrats seem to agree pretty much with that today. Other people have infrastructure or investment spending programs they want to put money in and so on. I suppose I am arguing for a reasonable course as opposed to slash and burn.
Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580 is Gordon Adams. He is the director of the Defense Budget Project in Washington, D.C. And we're talking about defense planning in the post-Cold War era. If you have questions, and I have several people lined up here to talk, you're certainly welcome. We do have the toll-free line, which is free right at the moment. That's 800-222-9455. And we do have the local line. That's 333-9455. But we do have several folks to talk with there. And we'll start right in with line number one. Hello.
Okay. Well, what is a reasonable amount then, though? I mean, the Bush administration is, if I'm not misled, is suggesting $50 billion over 5 years, which if you put that over $1.5 trillion for the explicitly military budget, it comes out to just about 3%. I've heard it's less than that, which, as you said, inflation could eat that up quite easily, depending on how things go. So even the Democrats are calling for $100 billion over the 5 years.
Which isn't that much more.
Which isn't that much more. It's 6%. I mean, so this is. And
but let me take you back to the basics here, where I started from. I think those numbers don't mean anything. They are measurements solely from last year's projected defense budget. If you look at last year's projected defense budget, between last year and 1997, it was going to be $250 or so billion dollars below the previous six-year budgetary projection. Now, what is your peace dividend in all of that? Is it the $250 billion it was below the previous year? Is it the $350 billion it was below what defense would have gotten if it just grew with inflation? Is it the $50 billion, which is the difference between last year and this year? Is it any of those numbers if both your defense planning baseline changes year by year and the inflation assumptions change year by year? I'm going to give you one small example. From last year to this year, the Defense Department, under the requirements of the Budget Enforcement Act, the Budget Summit Agreement, the Defense Department found $12 billion worth of projective money that it no longer put into its plan simply because they'd reestimated inflation. Every year, when we go in our shop to argue about the defense budget and talk about the numbers, I have to throw out all the old numbers and start with some new numbers because every year those assumptions change. Those numbers sound ludicrous. And on the face of it, they are, but I'm saying they are also invisible numbers. What I'm saying is what we ought to be doing is setting a long-term trajectory, and at the end of that trajectory, a given size of force, we're about to put out a force structure of our own that we're going to project over the next probably 7 or 8 years that's lower, smaller than the base force and different from the base force that the Department of Defense has put out. What I can tell you is when I get out to the year 2000 or 2001, that force will cost me about $200 billion in 1992 uninflated dollars. You know, how fast I get there and how much the economy changes is what's going to determine the size of the peace dividend when I get there. But I cannot projectively tell you a number and have it carry any meaning at all. Now, there's something else, I think, too, that goes into this mix and is an important part of the answer to this question. Why do these numbers look so pitiful? Well, one of the things that makes it very hard to pull lots of bucks out of defense very fast, alongside the other reasons that I named, is that the politicians of America have discovered something very interesting, and that is the defense fits into your state or your district. We're here in the confines of an area close to an air base in Rantoul. People know the impact on a local district when you start changing defense expenditures. Those are as local expenditures as any other kind of expenditure. And members of Congress who have been anxious to reap a peace dividend and reap it quickly have discovered this year that there is a rock and a hard place in this argument for them. They have to maneuver somehow between the rock of the peace dividend and the hard place of jobs in my district. And that sets a kind of perceptual framework for a member of Congress, for the Democrats or the Republicans who deal with defense as a local issue. They don't want to go down too fast because that has direct, immediate, severe political local consequences for them. So there are a lot of forces that make this the kind of exercise that can be slow, carefully done, planned, and I think gets you to a very decent, much smaller sized force with a certain constituency of support for it.
Well, I would define the peace dividend as, if we look back on the previous year, how much has actually been diverted into local industrial policy, social spending increases, and that sort of thing, and look at it and try to develop a constituency that will hold politicians to an increase of that kind of defined as looking at how the priorities have changed year by year. But I wanted to also question the baseline in the sense that the Cold War is over. It's like a sea change. I don't buy it. A lot of the people in the peace movement don't buy it. I never believed for the last decade that the Eastern European countries were going to be some kind of monolithic force against Western Europe. So one surmises that all of those expenditures were for completely ulterior motives, and that's very heterodox. It's very against conventional wisdom, but I think the baseline should be much, much below what we spent last year or the last year before the so-called, you know, dramatic sea change of the end of the Cold War. There was some, obviously some threat of an offense by the Eastern Bloc, but the Bloc was already deteriorating much before this has come along, and the Poles were not going to take an offensive march into Germany with the Soviets. It's ludicrous, and that's another thing that never gets spoken about. But don't buy the baseline and look back on what priorities have actually changed from year to year. Thanks.
Well, we may have some disagreements about what we think is true of history here, and I'm not sure that we'll get very far trying to argue those out in the next 15 or 20 minutes. But let me just underline one point. One of the perpetual arguments that we've had in American national security planning since the end of the Vietnam War is whether or not the United States is going to play an active international role, diplomatic, political, economic, military, or whether it is not. And we tend to define that argument in extremes. That's either an isolationist or an internationalist or a world policeman. We use rhetoric around this argument of the role of the United States. And as we have done that, what we saw happen in the 1970s was that the bottom fell quite sharply out of military spending. It went down to about 4.5% of GNP, which was historically low without precedent before the Second World War until 1939. And then we had, in the face of that, the Committee on the Present Danger and that ilk who came in and determined that we had basically sold out American national defenses, and we had an argument that probably pushed defense spending in directions that the caller would agree with, that is to say, far above what may have been the military requirements of the 1980s. We are now engaged in the same kind of wrangle, and what I'm trying to suggest is, given the changes in the world, given the role of military forces in America's national strategy, that what we ought to be doing is setting a trajectory that enough people can agree on that when we get to the end of it, we don't go through the loops anymore. We're pretty much in consensus that we're at the right level.
Again, our guest this morning is Gordon Adams. He is the director and founder of the Defense Budget Project, which is a Washington-based independent group that provides analysis on defense issues. It was founded in 1983, and Gordon Adams is spending some time here on the U of I campus, and we're glad he's come by and spent some time with us today. We have, again, several callers holding, so we want to try to include everybody, and we'll go on here to talk with someone on line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
My question is concerns the program on 60 Minutes a few weeks ago about the overbuying of things like uniforms, toilet seats, blankets, et cetera, and that we have many, many warehouses filled with all sorts of equipment that we're never going to use, and that this is a large, I guess they did say something like $1 billion a year. Is there any truth to this, and if so, what can be done to alleviate the problem?
Well, there certainly is truth to it. After all, I like to call the Defense Department sometimes the biggest Sears and Roebuck in the country. They just buy reams and reams and reams of stuff, from large hardware programs down to nuts and bolts and screws and uniforms and boots and shoes. The almost natural instinct of a bureaucracy in doing buying like that without relatively close checking is to make sure that you have an enormous stockpile, and then when, you know, Officer X, Y, or Z comes through and says we have to fix System A or we have to provide for Troop Complement B, sometimes it's very hard to put your finger on the button that gets you to where that stuff is in the supply system, and it's faster to go out and order it again and buy it, and so you leave some of that stuff in the depot. And the General Accounting Office has been pretty clear about their audit on this thing. There are billions of dollars worth of surplus property ordered over the years by the services, and one of the areas over time that we think you can achieve considerable savings in defense is through consolidation and efficiency effort in the defense infrastructure, whether it's in the supply depots or the maintenance installations or the education and training installations, the health services and health facilities. Over time, we probably spend, I would say, something like a third of the military dollar, somewhere between a quarter and a third, on these features of the defense infrastructure. And as we bring forces down, we have to bring down the size and the operations of that infrastructure as well. We have to get closer to what the private sector calls just-in-time inventory in the military than they have been for a long, long time.
Well, is it possible to have some sort of a sale on the equipment that we have stored away in all these warehouses that we spend money on every year.
Oh, sure. At some point, you're going to see some of that dumped into to resale markets. There's no question as the force structure comes down, we'll need less of it.
How long do you think that's going to take?
Some of it happens year by year, but I think there's a fair amount of energy to do it reasonably quickly now.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go on here. Caller on line number 3. Hello.
Oh, good morning, David. Mm-hmm. Enjoyed what your guest has to say. I have a question for him. The concern I have is that, by the way, I agree with most of what I forget your name, I apologize, but what you've said. But I'm concerned about, I hear a lot of politicians going on and on about how the, you know, that not just the peace dividend, but that the Cold War is over and that the traditional threat that I've faced in my, I'm 41, so I've lived with my whole life is gone, and I don't see that it's gone yet. To me, I think there's a real possibility of the Soviet Union recoalescing, at least in part, into some other sort of nuclear threat, which is the whole big deal. I mean, do you have any? I mean, I like your idea of winding down slowly because it seems to accommodate that scenario. But I mean, what do you feel about that?
I don't think that there's any area of American policy right now that's probably more important in terms of our national security than how we deal with the disintegration of the Soviet Union. And it is a classic example to me of the need for a national strategy. That is to say, if you accept the premise that I laid out at the beginning, which is your national strategy includes your political diplomatic capabilities, your economic capabilities, and your military capabilities, then those three things need to be working in synergy in terms of how we deal with the collapsing Soviet Union. So people are always prepared to say, well, you ought to be doing X instead of Y. I don't think it's an either-or proposition. But what we don't have right now is any clearly sustained vision about how we should deal with a collapsing Soviet Union. Probably the best way to describe it is if you want a peace dividend and you want it to be long-term, you want to do as much as we can do, and there are limits on our ability to do it. I'm not talking fiscally, and Russia is a big country with a lot of problems they have to solve on their own, but you want to do as much as you can do to assist the transition to democratic politics and a market economy in that area, because you don't want to see a restoration of the kind of threat that we had to deal with for the past 40 years. And that means you have to work diplomatically in coalitions through NATO, through the CSCE, to structure security equations that are reassuring in that region. You have to work economically. That is to say, we have to cobble together a package of assistance to the states that succeeded the Soviet Union that assist that transition. For example, I can't imagine any two decisions that are more important right now than a currency stabilization support fund, which doesn't cost you money unless it runs away with itself, and overseas private investment corporation loan guarantees to businesses investing in the republics that were formerly part of the Soviet Union. Those are two relatively near-term cost-free steps that could make a big difference to the evolution of the economy there. And you have to think in terms of the military planning as well. Now, that can mean, I think, considerably reduced requirements for American military forces forward deployed in Europe. But it also means working with the Soviet military in terms of the consolidation and dismantling of their nuclear capability and in terms of their own changed force planning for the requirements of Russian national security. It means we have to be in dialogue and regular interaction with them and with the other republics, Ukraine, Kazakhstan in particular,
yes,
to ensure that you have some stability in that region in terms of military planning.
So
you have to combine all three elements, and I think that's one area. I don't call it a Marshall Plan because I don't think the issue here is throwing money at it. The issue here is linking your diplomatic and economic measures with your military interactions so you can bring some more secure long-term evolution to the security situation over there.
I have a follow-up. By the way, I agree with everything you just said, 100%. This is not my question, but isn't that sort of what ex-President Nixon's report was sort of about?
I find myself in the distinctly uncomfortable position of finding that I agreed almost entirely with the statement put forward with Richard Milhouse Nixon on the subject. It has not, however, been picked up either by the administration as yet,
right,
or by the Democratic candidates for the presidency or the leadership on Capitol Hill.
Right. Here's my last question. I agree with everything you've said, and I hope that we can bring some aspect of our way of life to the Soviet Union and make their lives better. My concern is it's sort of the flea on the elephant problem is I'm not sure that we have the power to change events over there, and that's why my concern about the military is a kind of a, I guess what I have is a go slow for the next 5 years is kind of the way I feel about it. You know, do everything we can, but I'm not sure that what we are going to do is going to have a, you know, diplomatically and economically, I agree with investment in the Soviet Union. I think if I was a young man again, I think that's where I'd be looking for opportunities, but...
Hey, you're only 41. You're a young man.
Yeah, I know. I'm not 25 when I was a much bigger risk taker. But listen, if you could just respond to that, I guess...
I agree. I think I said in passing that we have to be careful about the limits on our capacity to influence events there. I have been over in Russia twice in the last 18 months, and if anything strikes you about discussing these problems with Russian politicians or business people, industrialist planners, whatever they are, is the almost uncoordinatable chaos that will afflict them as they go through this transition. That's why I say don't throw money at the problem. You want to find your points of leverage, but be prepared to acknowledge that a lot of that evolution is the responsibility of the Russian people and the Russian government and the Ukrainians and the Kazakhstanis, and they are going to have to manage that process by and large as best they can. Our ability to leverage has very sharp limitations. You can see it in almost the way anybody's approaching this. I had conversations a month or so ago with a big investment company in the United States that is over in Russia trying to find potential investments. They're building an investment fund to invest in Russia. And they screened, I think, 200 or more companies, 200 or 300 companies that are currently in various types of defense production in Russia, and screened them over a two-year period and limited themselves down to six that they think are viable investments for U.S. capital in this investment fund. Well, that says there's a long way to go before much of that economy is in a shape to really call itself healthy. Having said that, therefore, I think indeed it is appropriate to take a measured response to the reduction of U.S. military forces. But in addition to taking a measured approach to it, I would engage the Russians and the Ukrainians and the Kazakhstani directly. That is to say, I would go over and be working with them, with their military people, with their ministries of defense, with the legislators. We're involved in a project that does this with Russian, Kazakhstani, and Ukrainian legislators on how the legislature does oversight on national security. Not because we can make them all do things different, but because through that process of dialogue, we will have some impact on how they view their security situation. So you want to do both things. You don't want to say it's either or. Your strategy has to consist of mixing your political, diplomatic, your economic, and your military.
Our time is moving along pretty rapidly, as it does on this program, and there are a couple of other people we really want to include. I would like to have you talk for a minute or two about what your feeling is about the character of the defense force that you think that we should be working toward, if that is in fact possible to do that briefly. What sort of defense do you think we need?
Well, if I were God or the Secretary of Defense, and I think I'm more likely to become God than the Secretary of Defense, I would sort of plant a military planning flag about 8 to 10 years out with a force structure. I'll set aside for the moment how it fits internationally with our national strategy, but just for the purposes of addressing the question, I'd set a force structure that was about something like 9 or 10 active army divisions and about 6 reserve. We're now at 18 and 10. It would fix the Air Force target at roughly 21 active and reserve air wings. We're now at 36. It would set the Navy at about 350 ships and about 9 or 10 carrier battle groups. Right now we have 530 with 12 carrier battle groups. So it's a considerably shrunk force, but over a lengthy period of time that allows you to adjust that trajectory as you go along and encounter what you need to encounter in the world. That force, though, would not just be smaller. It would also be a force that was based largely in the United States, with some basing in Asia, minimal in Europe, where I think the military requirement is going to decline over time. Possibly some in the Middle East, but more likely to be mobilizable to the Middle East and stationed in the Middle East. That is a force with both heavy and light capabilities that emphasizes sea lift and airlift in order to get to the places that it has to go when it needs to get there. that retains, and here I differ with the administration considerably, that retains a full-up 3 Marine Corps division capability, because if you're going to do missions in the post-Cold War world, that's the kind of capability you're most likely to want. There's a bureaucratic problem there. Right now we're bringing the Marine Corps down by about 2/3 of a division in manpower, largely for political reasons. You know, everybody's got to pay their share of the pain, but not because people have thought through the military planning exercise for the forces you need. That structure of forces that I just very briefly outlined would probably cost, once we're there, about $200 billion in 1992 dollars. That's something like, it's not quite a 50% cut. It's about a 40% reduction on where we currently are in terms of defense spending. I can't tell you the cumulative figure between now and then what it would save you, because that's going to depend on planning vectors and economic assumptions. And I don't know what those are. I know it'll be cheaper, and I can point you backwards and say it's enough. I think that size force allows you, based largely in the United States, to continue to play a role in the security equation in Europe, to be able to address issues in the Middle East if we have to and rotate forces, to do smaller, minimal amphibious type or airdropped landings, to sail a navy in the Pacific that's not massive, it's probably a little bit smaller than what we have today, but allows you to continue to be present in the security equations in regions that make a difference to our interests and in which our allies want us to play as a form of reassurance to them. And it's large enough to deter potential adversaries from posing a threat to you or your allies. It can work in coalition and combination with coalitions that can be constructed in different regions. And is considerably cheaper than the forces that we now have. Now, that's a real quick exercise for something most planners probably take weeks to come up with, including ourselves, but that's basically the framework.
We have just about 10 minutes left. Again, let me reintroduce our guest. He is Gordon Adams. He's director of the Defense Budget Project in Washington, D.C. And our lines are full here. We'll try to get in as many callers as we can. We'll just have to ask the callers to try to be brief and to the point. That way we'll accommodate as many folks as possible. Let's go to line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
My question, I guess, is a little different from the ones that have been asked so far, in that I want to address one of the, to me, implicit assumptions or problems that this discussion was leading to. And that is this. Is there in the speaker's mind any contradiction between what is good for American security and what's good for international security?
Well, I think any one country always has a certain amount of contradiction between what may be its own direct unilateral interests and what are, you know, whatever global interests are, whatever international security issues are. There's always some tension there. I do not think that the United States ought to be redefining what international security means strictly in American national security interests. So there are going to be some differences, but one of the things that you do know is that we live in an increasingly integrated world, whether it's in terms of communications or in terms of economics. That is to say that there is an ever-increasing interdependence of major and minor nations around the globe on each other, and that interdependence is going to need to be managed. Some dimensions of that management are military, but most dimensions are economic and diplomatic. As I say, those are not in contradistinction to each other, but need to be integrated in any country's national security planning. The difficulty that we get into is if we say that this is an either-or game, that there is a set of international security interests, whatever they are, that are utterly opposed to what the United States may define as its security interests, we'll miss a whole array of problems that are somewhere between the two, which have some dimensions for American interests and slightly other dimensions for other countries' interests. I mean, it's a tough question to answer because I think it's a continuum and not a dichotomy.
No, I agree. It is a continuum to some extent. I suppose the difference is that, when one thinks of a new world order, the end of the Cold War and things like that, it seems to me that this would be, apart from a time to redefine American national security interests and so on, a time to think seriously about international security and perhaps the privileging of international security over American national interests. as America slides down the economic pole and becomes less of a major actor in the international trading system, and I don't mean losing its centrality, but losing its predominance, I guess.
That has already happened, of course.
Fine.
That's history.
As that goes on, and you have, you know, the increasing economic pressures of downscaling military options, would it not be a pragmatic, and I mean purely in the best realist sense of the word, a pragmatic way to proceed in terms of reducing military tensions worldwide and dealing with internal economic problems by giving international security objectives, which might occasionally go against American objectives, priority in order to sort of solve more problems than simply looking at it from a very Americocentric point of view?
My problem is I'm not sure what those international security objectives are. One of the tensions that I think is going to continue to exist in American diplomatic and military planning over the next 20 or 30 years is where are there capacities that can deal with conflict situations in regions where the United States doesn't have a particularly strong interest, but conflict is an undesirable thing to happen. Who could handle those responsibilities, and what role the United States should play in those responsibilities? Now, I'm thinking here particularly of what are typically called UN peacekeeping missions.
Right.
The big one right now, of course, is Cambodia, and the second biggest one is in Yugoslavia. In neither case do I think it seems appropriate for the United States to unilaterally introduce military forces. In both cases, it seems to me appropriate that the United States cooperate and help fund, which is now an issue, the international presence of military forces as peacekeeping forces in those two regions. I would go further myself, and I know that in Washington people aren't prepared to go this far. That is to say, I see no reason in the long run why the United States military forces should not be part of international peacekeeping missions. We've kept those forces out of those missions deliberately. We don't want them to be targets of attack. We don't want to attract anti-American sentiment for a whole series of reasons. We also fund our participation in such exercises through the State Department and not through the Defense Department. In the long term, I see no reason why those we shouldn't be thinking seriously about how American military forces collaboratively and collectively with other nations work in regions of that kind and, in fact, participate as military forces, and why that isn't part of defense planning and defense budgeting.
Well, I agree with you.
Having been said,
yes.
one does not want to lose the capability to direct your own forces. You do not want your forces commanded internationally. I think almost no country is prepared to ask that their forces be commanded in perpetuity internationally. So you have a continuum where you want capabilities to have and use your forces according to the protection of your own interests, and where you want to be building coalitions and working forces internationally.
I suppose, you know, what I was thinking, I agree with you, I'm glad you said that, but it was more that, for example, look at a place where United States forces today are being located, namely Latin America, the whole drug problem.
Mm-hmm.
To my understanding, the likelihood of American military force in Peru and Bolivia being able to solve the drug problem is impossible.
And in fact, Peruvians will tell you, I've talked with Peruvian military officers about this, they don't want American military forces in Peru playing a role in the drug problem precisely for
that
reason.
And it's not going to solve the problem anyway. So
no.
That's
but the American military is extremely reluctant, I will add, to direct its military forces into countries like Bolivia and Peru to play a role in the drug problem. The Pentagon doesn't want that mission.
So this is what I mean. An international security problem like the drug trade need not be able to be solved by force alone. Perhaps then looking at...
Almost certainly not, I would say.
Well, that's the whole... You know, if this is the new world we're living in, all this discussion about downscaling and renegotiating and so on might just be missing the point. But thank you for your comments.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, I want to try and sneak one more caller in here, line number two. Hello.
Yes, I'm interested in your... relationship to another organization in Washington, the Center for Defense Information of Admiral LaRoc.
No relationship.
Well, I know, but how would you compare your organization with his? I know his is largely made up of retired military officers. And what sort of mission do they envision for themselves, and how does it relate to the one that you envision for yourself?
It's very hard for me to speak for them. I don't know how they envisage their mission. So it's very hard for me to address it. We are a research. I'd probably say we are more of a research organization, and they are more of an advocacy organization with respect to defense issues. That's about as far as I think I could push it.
Mm-hmm. And there's a second question I have with respect to LaRoc. What sort of contribution would you say that LaRock has made with respect to the relationship of the United States and the Soviet Union in terms of disarmament?
Can't answer the question since I don't know what they've done.
I see. Would you say that he has made an important contribution in all of this sort of debate?
Impossible for me to evaluate. I don't know.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
Okay, well, we're at the point where I think we're going to have to stop, and we've come to the end of the time. I want to thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
We appreciate it.